I'm Andy Burnham and welcome to Sparks. This week, improved prospects for B Sky B, new competition for Coronation Street and EastEnders. Pseudoscience, alive and kicking in hi-fi circles, we investigate green rubber CD condoms and more. Analog watch ICs. Do you know that modern watch chips for analog watches only draw 100 nanoamps from the battery? Are they all barking mad at the DTI? Out of four telepoint operators, three have now gone bust. The remaining operator hasn't started yet. The DTI seems set to repeat the mistake. More on that later. A breakthrough in microscopic electric motors. Radio 3 secrets revealed to the Audio Engineering Society. 20-bit digital recording at Abbey Road Studios. Marketing hype or more clarity to classical music. Plus, we look at FEM FM, Atlantic 252, and more. And also your letters on Sparks on Radio Fax 6205 and 12255.
We'll be right back. more attractive dish, Raymond Snoddy, on improved prospects for B Sky B in the Financial Times. British Sky Broadcasting, B Sky B, the satellite television channel, is planning to launch a daily domestic serial next autumn. If the project goes ahead, it is unlikely that the programme schedulers at the BBC or ITV will begin quaking in their boots, or that the massive audiences for established soaps such as Coronation Street or EastEnders will experience anything but a tiny blip in the ratings. But the move will be enormously significant all the same. A year ago, two stricken satellite companies, British Satellite Broadcasting and Sky Television, agreed, in conditions of extreme secrecy, to merge. At that moment, the two companies employed a total of 4,300 people, including Sky's satellite dish installation staff. We're broadcasting 9 channels of television to a tiny audience and making combined losses of around £2 million a day. That 1 year later, Mr. Gary Davey, Deputy Managing Director of B Sky B, should be considering commissioning a multi-million pound soap from an independent UK production company is a small symbol of the transformation in the atmosphere and prospects at the modest Sky headquarters at Austerlitz in West London. In showing how the £1.4 billion B Sky B venture has progressed 1 year after the painful merger, a few numbers are more eloquent than 1,000 pictures from the 6 channels of television the company transmits by satellite every day. The 6 channels are now put out by 980 people, including about 300 at the Subscription Management Centre at Livingston in Scotland. Weekly losses have been reduced to £1.8 million, the average over the past 4 weeks, although this figure rises to £4.8 million a week when financing charges are included. The satellite service, which goes under the name of Sky Television, and in which Mr. Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation has a 50% stake, and 3 major shareholders, Granada, Pearson, publishers of the Financial Times, and Chargeurs of France, hold most of the remainder, is now claiming to be available in 2.5 million homes through cable, dish, and communal aerial. B Sky B, with the help of massive promotion and special discount deals, has sold 22,000 dishes a week and is expected to notch up a total of 100,000 for October, which would make it the best sales month since the merger. Mr. Davey is particularly interested in a set of numbers that goes beyond crude totals of satellite receiving homes. B Sky B is now available in 11.6% of television-owning households in the UK. But because the people most interested in satellite television tend to be families with young children, those homes account for 15% of the population. For 17.5% of the 16 to 24-year-olds, and for 22% of 4 to 15-year-olds, a youthful and attractive market for advertisers. We have a great deal of information about our audience. It's head down and backside up and getting on with it time, said Mr. Davey. Mr. Sam Chisholm, B Sky B's managing director, believes that the satellite venture has been handed a golden opportunity because of the potential disarray in ITV following the tenders for new television licences. As a result, apart from contemplating his own soap opera, Mr. Davey is also running his eye over possible programming deals with Thames Television, the leading ITV company to lose its franchise. Sky Television would be very interested in acquiring a package of programmes that would include The Bill, the twice-a-week Thames police drama. Perhaps the most important numbers of all for Sky are the percentages prepared to subscribe to one of the 2 subscription film channels. Of the 1.7 million homes with a dish, more than 60% are paying £11.99 a month for a film channel, And of that number, 60% are paying £16.99 a month for both film channels. In the latest marketing wheeze, new Dish owners are given an immediate smart card to unlock the subscription channels on the understanding that they sign a direct debit within a few weeks. If they do not sign, they are cut off. As a result, Sky hopes to increase take-up rates of subscription channels to 75%. Mr. Chisholm has no illusions about the continuing challenge he faces. That we are still here is a great tribute to the staff, management, and vision and drive of Rupert Murdoch, he says diplomatically. But if Dish sales continue at anything like their present rate, Sky television channels should be in 3.5 million homes by the end of 1992, taking it to break even in operational terms. Some city analysts are now starting to produce large estimates for Sky B's value, basing their work on methods developed to value other large projects, such as Eurotunnel. SG Warburg Securities believes the venture's present value, despite its losses and its debt, could be £2 billion. The figure is based on the assumption that the company continues to install new dishes at the rate of 60,000 a month, and that the proportion of film channel subscribers holds. No one can guarantee that this will happen, or that there is not a ceiling to growth. All About Sky Television there by Raymond Snoddy in the Financial Times.
Years of Radio Jackie. This LP record traces the story from early operations in fields through High Street Studios to the final close down.
Police with tracker dogs and post office detection men raided a pirate radio station in South London yesterday. Radio Jackie, which was said to broadcast for 6 hours every Sunday afternoon, was manned by about 15...
On March the 7th, 1972, Radio Jackie made parliamentary history when a tape of the station was played to a committee of the House of Commons during a debate on the Sound Broadcasting Bill. This tape, the first ever to be played in the House, was used to illustrate how commercial radio could sound if it were legalised in Great Britain.
Radio Jackie!
Jackie! Jackie!
The station that fits snugly into your ear.
Radio Jackie, the sound of Southwest London. Radio Jackie, the sound of Southwest London.
This is Channel 4.
A new crackdown on pirate radio by the Independent Broadcasting Authority. But is the IBA acting in the public interest?
This is Angela Rumbold, Member of Parliament for Mitcham and Morden. As many of you will know who are regular listeners to Radio Jackie, the government has introduced legislation recently which may put Radio Jackie's future at jeopardy.
From the bustle of suburbia to the rolling Surrey Downs,
from houseboats on the River Thames to office blocks in town, close enough to really care as Brit should always be. London's favourite station, Radio Jackie.
In the last 16 years, I mean, Radio Jackie's done nothing but good, and the events leading to its closure are monstrous.
These fascinating recordings with a booklet of photographs all about Radio Jackie are yours for £6. For Europe, it's £8. And with airmail to the rest of the world, £10. Order your copy now from Radio Jackie, 120 London Road, Morden, England, SM4 5AT.
You're listening to Radio Facts, And the programme is Sparks. Every Monday and Tuesday, it's our weekly look at technical, scientific and media news. A letter now from John Winson from Michelover in Derby. Dear Sparks, he writes, I've been listening to your transmissions for some weeks now. I particularly like the technical titbits, readings of technical info from various electronic and scientific magazines. The more you do of this, the better as far as I'm concerned. I listen to you on a portable radio, a Uniden CR2021. And he asks what our hours of transmission are. Well, I've mentioned this programme. On Wednesdays and Thursdays, it's Paul with his selection of music and strange facts. Fridays and Saturdays, it could be the archive programme, or it could be Jodie's rock show, or it could be something even stranger. And on Sunday, it's each week, a featured year from Paul again. So John's letter continues. I am an electronic engineer, a keen shortwave listener, and I've passed my RAE, but I don't have a transmitter. And I'm interested in hi-fi, radio and electronics. He asks what tape recorders we use. Well, on Trevor's side, an Aiwa AD460, that's for playout, and Memorex machine from Tandy. These are the auto-reverse ones. My Aiwa model, just looking down. The reason I couldn't find it is it's written on the door, which has just fallen off because it's glued on with glue, because I tried to prise the door off to get to the azimuth, thinking that it just clipped off, but on this tape deck it's sort of glued on. Anyway, it's an R450, my auto-reverse. I also use a Sony TCFX4 and a Trio KX1000D. I'm sure you'll be fascinated to hear, John. So, if you're interested in writing a letter, which I guarantee to read out on air, the address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. If you'd like a reply in writing to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1. And the address again, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. Thank you. an IC maker to swatch. Appalling pun from Richard Baum visiting Switzerland to see a wafer handling line that uses robot arms throughout. Turn on a 60-watt bulb for a second and it will use enough energy to power the chip used in many Swiss watches for 7 years. It is a claim Mukhard Darwish makes with good measures of pride and authority. He is president of EM Microelectronic Marlin, whose leading-edge low-power processes have made it the largest manufacturer of ICs for analog watches in Europe and given it a 17% world share. It's part of the SMH Group, the largest Swiss watch manufacturer, and the name behind brands such as Swatch and Omega. Since its establishment in 1975, the company has developed ever more efficient ICs, the best of which consume less than 100 nanoamps at the 1.5 volts that a watch battery supplies. Despite its sophisticated technologies, the company is virtually unknown outside its customer base. But among many IC manufacturers, EM is a name to be reckoned with, and several, including Philips, Hitachi and Intel, have formed partnerships with it. With Hitachi, it is working on packaging technologies, but it's the tie-up with Intel that is the most intriguing. Intel supplied EM with its 6-inch wafer handling know-how, and the companies now have what Darwish called a long-term development program. Although he would not disclose the details, he stressed with a broad smile that EM was an expert in low power and miniaturization. It appears Intel wants to obtain EM's analog low-power ALP processes, so the results of that coalition could be seen in the near future. It's Sparks on Radio Fax 6205 and 12255.
Is the people here grow colder? I turn to my computer and spend my evenings with it like a friend. I was loading. Person.
Now, are they all barking mad at the DTI? Two views, firstly from the Electronics Weekly. The last thing Britain needs is another mobile telephone operator. A recession-hit UK economy is already struggling to support its existing mobile operators. Three out of four Telepoint licences have failed, and there are still nagging doubts about how the new Personal Communications Network, or PCN, operators will compete with their established cellular rivals. Almost everyone is convinced that in mobile communications, more is not always the merrier. Everyone, that is, except the government. The government is currently overhauling the entire radio spectrum allocation process. It seems set on uncovering some long-forgotten band of frequencies which can be licensed to prospective mobile service providers for cash. John Redwood, the telecommunications minister, argues that the spectrum review, with the possibilities of new licences and more competitive pricing, has more to do with making more efficient use of the radio spectrum than raising new revenues. The government wants people occupying spectrum for good purposes, and not just for the sake of occupying it, he said. The Treasury is already in line to get over a quarter of £1 billion a year from the recently awarded commercial TV franchises. So the current practice of a one-off payment for a 15-year mobile service licence is unlikely to be tolerated for much longer. An overhaul of the radio spectrum is long overdue. A recent review of spectrum use between 3.4 GHz and 30 GHz made 10 recommendations improving frequency allocation in the UK. The spectrum below 3 GHz is tied up with existing mobile services, such as private mobile radio, paging, both analogue and GSM digital cellular, and PCN. So Redwood's search for new frequencies can be expected to draw on the recommendations of this review. It is clear that in future the government will no longer sanction the use of microwave radio links for use in fixed telephone networks simply to reduce operating costs. The report recommends that as a general principle, fixed link traffic within mature networks should be carried by cable wherever practicable to release radio spectrum for other uses. And it suggests that pricing should be used to discourage unnecessary use of radio. A substantial addition to the annual licence fee should be considered to reflect the opportunity cost of using radio and to encourage the use of cable, the report concludes. Half of the radio spectrum between 3.4 and 30 GHz is used for these fixed links, so there is scope for pruning. The government is expected to start by forcing British Telecom, the largest user of fixed radio links, to free up spectrum below 10 GHz. Redwood may also consider using frequencies which currently are controlled by the Ministry of Defence. The review suggests that in certain areas, civil applications could share military spectrum. Examples include mobile services at 5.8 GHz and 27 GHz, and 8 MHz fixed links at 14 GHz. The probability is that the government will have no trouble laying its hand on new frequencies, such as the historical slack in the spectrum. What is less clear is the type of service it would be prepared to license. A new generation of high-definition TV services are anticipated later in the decade, once the EC gets its act together. These services, to be broadcast from satellites, will require 50 MHz chunks of spectrum. The UK may be forced by international pressure to find space in the 22 GHz band for wideband high-definition television, in addition to narrowband HDTV or D2 MAC at 12 GHz. Car navigation systems are other potential users of microwave spectrum, and the review recommended that a band of frequencies at 5.2 GHz, once used for aeronautical systems, should be allocated for land mobile navigation systems. Redwood said last week he hoped some of the old fun and enthusiasm would return to the UK's mobile communications market. That's a big 10-4, John, good buddy. When it does, you can expect the government to make the most of it. The Treasury will then take some convincing that the last thing Britain needs is another mobile telephone network, as long as it pays.
And here's Peter Firth writing in the Electronics Times in rather more descriptive language on the same subject. The mongoose's prime source of food is snakes, yet mongooses run the risk of being killed by snakes. There are plenty of other equally nutritious sources of food the mongoose could eat, yet it continues to dice with death by pursuing poisonous serpents, hence the expression, as mad as a mongoose. one of the presentations at a mobile telecommunications conference last week might have suggested to some in the audience that it is time to coin a new madness simile. As mad as a minister would be an ideal candidate. It is not that John Redwood, Minister for Corporate Affairs, risks coming unstuck because of a taste for snakes. His apparent madness is expressed more by a taste for repeating mistakes, and in particular, mistakes that have led to howls of protest in the past. In his speech, he said that the government would open up new frequency bands, some of which had been reserved for military or commercial use. He hinted that more mobile licenses would be granted if spectrum could be found. Where does Redwood seriously expect to find the spectrum? Are we going to see a mad minister out with a magnifying glass looking for bandwidth? Or does he hope to hand out new licenses where others have failed? He might not have many takers. Two of the three PCN licenses have decided to share the same network infrastructure. In a market with two cellular operators, three PCN operators, and the potential of several telepoint operators, they probably decided it was the only way to achieve a satisfactory return on the investment. What is the reason for all this? There is no easy answer to that, but one thing is certain. When the three telepoint operators got into difficulties, people were swift to blame the government for licensing too many competitors. The market, they said, was not big enough to support them all. There were other reasons, such as poor marketing and proprietary standards, but the end result of licensing too many operators was that some were forced out of business. That meant that the whole exercise had failed to achieve the government's goal. Too much competition in a finite-sized market destroyed the very competition it was supposed to foster. So why is the government apparently bent on freeing up the radio spectrum and licensing more mobile operators? Could it be that it hopes to make money by auctioning frequency spectrum? After all, Redwood said that as soon as spectrum was found, he would publicise the fact. Then he said, "We will decide whether to hold a competition between those interested in using the spectrum." Is the government's commitment to the open market a sham and a thinly disguised way of making easy money, perhaps? Or could it really be the result of a strange madness that leaves ministers addicted to the sound of the squeals of protest as more companies go out of business because of the government's slavery to the open market? The mongoose knows that a snake is edible as long as it does not wind up dead while trying to catch one. Redwood and his party colleagues should remember that if they get this wrong, the deadly election snake is waiting to bite. Peter Firth, writing in no uncertain terms in Electronics Times. Also in the same issue, there's a small item, DTI cash slashed. The industry department is one of the few whose budget has been cut in the recent autumn statement. However, the DTI still plans to increase its spending on innovation over the next 3 years. Spending by the DTI is forecast to fall to £940 million in 92-93, £10 million less than forecast, and in real terms half its level for 1988-89. However, Industry Secretary Peter Lilly stressed that the innovation budget aimed at supporting industrial R&D would rise. All this cashing in on the radio spectrum, rather different from the views of free radio, of course, that spectrum is a God-given right and should be free.
Going great, and they're only getting better. I'm
Now it's Laurie Taylor and the radio programme, BBC Radio 4.
If that new station ever does get on air, it'll be interesting to see if it features any female music presenters or DJs. Recent research by Atlantic 252, the Irish-based longwave station which transmits 24 hours a day to Britain, found that of all the DJs on UK independent stations, only 8% were female. And within this 8%, only 23%, or to put it more straightforwardly, a grand total of 17 female DJs, had a regular daily show. As Jane Markham found out when she went to look at Atlantic 252's Jock Search, a competition to find new female DJs, such a shortfall could hardly be attributed to lack of interest in the job.
The hits of the world, Atlantic 252.
Hello, Atlantic 252 listeners. This is Linda Wright from Wimbledon. I don't play tennis, but I do play records in my spare time.
Hi, I'm Evelyn Brown at Tartan Terror on Atlantic 252, a Scottish blonde with a taste for Scottish music, and I don't mean the Highland Fling.
Hi there, folks. I hope I'm coming through loud and clear from the Emerald Isle. My name's
After Tony. Launching Jock Search 91 to find a female presenter, Atlantic 252 received more than 2,500 calls on their hotline and 110 tapes. The prize of a six-show contract with the station proved a major incentive.
Hello, good evening and welcome to Loopy Lou's 1 Minute Bit.
Loopy Lou, real name Louise Radwan, is a motorbike dispatch rider in London. Being a DJ was something she'd wanted to do but had never pursued until the competition.
Got my inspiration from Annie Nightingale. I think she's probably the best female DJ. It's only because of the competition that I thought more of it, because of the confidence that's been given to me through people obviously liking what I was doing.
Louise's story is a common one. Though many women want to DJ, they rarely consider it as a career, and they don't make demo tapes. Mark Story is programme director of Piccadilly Radio in Manchester. He's just been listening to the backlog of tapes that arrive on his desk.
We had 388, 389 tapes. 23 of those 388 tapes were from women. I talked to some of the people who sent in the tapes. A lot of those women were not interested in doing music programming as such, becoming disc jockeys, if you like. They were interested in doing feature material, interested in becoming journalists. The idea of becoming a disc jockey did not appeal to any of them, really.
Did they explain why?
I feel it may be something to do with conditioning. There aren't very many women role models in the pure music presenter mode.
Since Mark's story actively set out to recruit women, Piccadilly Radio's two services, Key 103 and Piccadilly Gold, now employ three women DJs out of a total of 30 presenters. Diana Luke, who currently presents an afternoon show on Greater London Radio, believes that most of the stations she's worked for have taken her on to fulfil an unofficial quota, and she's unhappy at the prospect of being employed as a token woman.
A token woman concerns me because it sort of implies that you don't have the talent, but you have the right sexuality, and that concerns me. I would like to think that I'm as good as, if not better, than my male colleagues who went for the same job at the same time. But it's very hard to know. But looking at whether it's a career that young women think about, I don't think it is. I mean, you don't think when you're 13, 14 that you're going to be a DJ. I think that still is very much a male attitude, that they're, you know, 15, 16 thinking, yeah, I want to get in there and I want to turn those tables and I want to have a good time. Well, women, I don't think, have the assertion or the confidence to get up in front of a microphone in that sense.
Drive Time on 1FM with Jackie Brambles.
Well, hello there, good evening. Welcome along to Drive Time, just about 4.5 minutes after 6 o'clock. 1FM, Jackie Brambles is here through till 7:30.
Radio 1's Jackie Brambles is one of the country's most high-profile women DJs, with the network's Drive Time show at 6 o'clock each weekday evening. But she, like most other successful women presenters, has never sent a demo tape to a radio station, neither did she have a burning ambition to do the job.
I just was working at a very small local commercial station in Scotland where I grew up, by Sound. And the only reason I was working there was to get some money to backpack around the world. And I was cleaning toilets and making tea. A DJ left very, very suddenly. And they just said to me, "Do you speak English?" "Yes." "Well, you're on." And suddenly, to have a woman on your station, that's really in vogue. That's, you know, we must do that. Capital Radio in London decided that they wanted one, and I was there, and they took me on. And then Radio 1 decided that they had to have one, so they poached me from Capital. So I was very, very lucky.
Have you come across sexism?
Frequently. Too many times to mention. Although I have to say that, yes, we do have to talk about it to point out to people that it's not fair that there aren't more women in it. But then again, sometimes I think we're hanging ourselves by putting ourselves on a soapbox and haranguing people. The few executive females in important positions across industry, across all industry in the country, whenever they're interviewed, say the only way to do it is quietly, by quietly getting to a powerful position where you can give women more jobs, where you can give women a break.
But not everyone agrees that it should take that long. The Radio Authority has granted a 2-week licence to an all-women radio station in Bristol, which will be broadcast during the city's International Women's Fortnight next March. Femme FM are hoping to dispel some of the myths surrounding women broadcasters. Caroline Mitchell is co-organising the project.
It is necessary to show that it can be done at all levels. It's an interesting experiment to see exactly what it does sound like. I mean, we, from all our discussions with people and all our planning with the programmes, we feel that there is so much material, there's so much wealth of women's experience that could be heard, that is just wasted at the moment because so much is controlled by male programme controllers, male presenters. It's time that there were more role models for women of all ages, hearing other women on air and knowing that women are making, for instance, major decisions about the programmes.
Until women are making the decisions, presenters like Diana Luke feel they'll always be pigeonholed.
A woman on radio is labelled much more than a man is. A man can come out with a sexual innuendo, and that is perfectly acceptable. But if a woman does, she is labelled. Or if she is too warm or effusive, therefore she's maternal. So you either are the mistress or the wife. When people say women shouldn't do the afternoon or the morning or a daytime major slot, I disagree. I think the problem is that the audience hasn't had the opportunity to find out if they're good at those jobs or not.
Do you think your Canadian accent has helped you?
Yeah, definitely, because they can't put a class to me. That drops one of the barriers immediately.
There is, of course, another possible reason why women aren't drawn to becoming music presenters. That's the perception that being a DJ is simply an outlet for an inflated male ego. But Mark Story says that type of presenter is a dying breed.
I think a lot of people think that a disc jockey is somebody who plays records and says stupid things and has very little between his two ears or her two ears. It's a very disciplined art where people have to say things that are interesting to their audience. They have to be perceptive. It's sad that women are not included in that and that we are missing that part of the human experience on the air. I think it's an unfortunate thing that we don't seem to be able to solve.
I'm the first mainstream daytime DJ Radio 1 has ever had in its 25-year history, so I do get loads of inquiries now, more than I can deal with. Mostly young girls, about 15, 16, saying, "I saw you on Going Live interviewing Jason Donovan, I want to do that, how do I do it?" Or saying, "I listened to your show and, you know, I really fancy doing that, how did you start?" There's a marked difference about the amount of mail we're getting from girls who say that they want to be DJs.
Jackie Brambles ending that report by Jane Markham.
That was from the radio programme on BBC Radio 4.
Hello to Chris Carrington, G0IYZ, writing from Chelliston in Derby. "I liked the attitude of the station and the presenters," he writes. "I also like the way in which the technical information was presented. It made even the most difficult details easier to understand. I was especially interested to hear the details of the new Polish station and the way that the staff are having to make do. Great stuff." He listens on a Trio TS940S general coverage transceiver and a Kenwood AT130 ATU, and he's got a G5RV multiband dipole antenna. A very precise reception report from Chris Carrington, who lists such things as his temperature at his location, the pressure, latitude, longitude, and his height above sea level.
swearing is sick revenge, but it jumped into the fantasy belong, songs belong. Swing like a river.
Why do people get worked up about 20-bit technology for audio? Is it just a case of marketing hype being used to sell a new range of machines? Richard Littleton, president of EMI Classics, argues that Abbey Road's investment in Mitsubishi technology has brought greater clarity to the recording of classical artists at their short-lived creative peaks. This is from ProSound News. Until recently, 20-bit recording technology suffered from what might be described as the pro-audio syndrome. It sounded great in theory, but despite the best intentions, failed to deliver the goods. So-called 20-bit systems would emerge to great applause, but cracking under the pressure gave way to the old established 16-bit regime. Earlier this year, however, EMI Classics, working closely with Abbey Road Studios, invested in the first commercially available 20-bit recording systems, namely two Mitsubishi PDX 8620 two-track digital recorders, fitted with 20-bit A to D and D to A converters. Abbey Road tested its new machines over a three-month period to assess the feasibility of setting up a 20-bit recording service. In particular, the engineers concentrated on running the machines with the studio's three Sonic Solutions systems to facilitate 20-bit editing and compilation. The results so far are as follows. The system works. And, according to the producers at EMI Classics, the difference in quality is marked. A dynamic range in excess of 100 dB offers noticeable improvements in clarity, particularly on solo instruments, such as piano. There are less problems with that digital noise. The imaging is better, and the sound is more three-dimensional. From an operational point of view, engineers have less need to worry about levels, and as many classical recordings are made direct to stereo, everything can be kept in the 20-bit domain until the last possible stage, when it comes to the final number crunch down to 16-bit. This is important because we, at last, have at our disposal a medium which is superior to those currently available on the domestic market. Of equal significance is the fact that we can now store 20-bit tapes in readiness for future release on improved consumer formats. This is important to EMI Classics' long-term plans because the life of a classical recording is so much longer than that of, say, a pop recording. As evidence of this, we are reissuing, with great success, recordings that were made 40 or 50 years ago. All this is fine, but the argument has so far ignored the three most important elements of the equation: the performance, the artist, and the consumer. First, the performance. A great performance, badly recorded, will still be a great performance. A lousy performance, beautifully recorded, will still be a lousy performance. No amount of technology can change this simple fact. And, if I have noticed one thing in the last 3 years, it is the fragility of a classical performer's art. Quite aside from the fact, from the act of heroism that enables artists to get up on a stage, they are at the height of their powers for so short a time, and they are not allowed the indulgence of disappearing into the studio for months. Indeed, they usually have one shot at getting it right, and that's it. It follows that we owe it to our artists to give them the best technology available, the best engineers and producers, and the best studios. Anything less would indicate an inability to recognise their immense contribution to the creative world. The addition of 20-bit facilities is therefore primarily a response to ensuring that the latest technology is available to the artists on the EMI Classics label, if they want it. Finally, to the consumer. While the classical music consumer has always been the most receptive to changes in technology, it is ultimately the quality of the performance, rather than the quality of sound, which is the most important factor in any buying decision. This said, many consumers will by now be aware of 20-bit technology and interested in its possibilities. So I think it appropriate that we keep abreast of all technological developments. If capturing the essence of a performance is the motivating force at EMI Classics, this creative commitment also brings commercial success. The company is now the second largest classical outfit in the world and fast catching up on the market leader. We are currently issuing between 200 and 300 releases a year, of which approximately 75 are new recordings, and our total worldwide sales in 1990 amounted to around 15 million units. This success offers further reassurance to our artists and is a mark of the faith that the consumer has in our recordings. Of course, there is clearly a partnership between the arts and technology. Artists do depend on the creativity of producers and engineers and the technical excellence offered by studios like Abbey Road. And somewhere within the delicate process of making records, the addition of 20-bit technology is an important development because it allows us to hear a voice or a piano more clearly and more realistically than ever before. In the end, however, it will always be the music rather than the machinery that sends shivers down the spine. That piece by Richard Littleton, who's president of EMI Classics.
This week on Sparks, improved prospects for B Sky B and new competition for Coronation Street and EastEnders. Pseudoscience, alive and kicking in hi-fi circles. We investigate green rubber CD condoms and more. Analog watch ICs. Are they barking mad at the DTI? A breakthrough in microscopic electronic motors. Radio 3 secrets revealed to the Audio Engineering Society. And some bits about FemFM, Atlantic 252, and of course your letters on Sparks from Radiofax.
Available now, a brand new Radio Caroline CD called The Legend Lives On. The CD contains 44 tracks taking you through some of the great events of Radio Caroline, from the first broadcasts in 1964 with Simon D, test transmissions from Caroline North with Daffy Don Allen, Tony Prince in 1966, other great names like Robbie Dale, Crispian St. John, Andy Archer and Peter Chicago. One track features the female DJs through the 80s, and you'll hear two memorable Caroline commercials and jingles, and about the collapse of the highest shipborne aerial mast anywhere in the world in 1987, plus shortwave test transmissions in 89 and the raid in that year on the Ross Revenge. All this is just a tiny fraction of what you'll hear on The Legend Lives On, a new 44-track CD available at £9.99 inclusive, only from these sources. SMC, PO Box 53121 at 1007 RC Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and from Chris Edwards, PO Box 1514, London W72LL in England. Radio Caroline, The Legend Lives On.
Alan Dean with a letter and his latest shortwave report. Many thanks for the copy of Radioactive received last month. Good to hear Holly back on the air again a few weeks ago, and her comments on broadcasting in Nepal were very interesting. Once again, I've enclosed the latest shortwave news, which I hope is of interest. Although I understand it cannot be helped, it's a shame the news doesn't go out for some 4 weeks after I send it in. Well, of course, when we get our license and some transmitters nice and gleaming in England, we'll be able to come to you much sooner. Radio Harmony went off air on the 16th of October at 9 o'clock in the evening. They've now returned using a new postbox, box 1651, Frinton-on-Sea in Essex. And their phone number, as mentioned last week, strangely enough, is the same phone number as East Anglian Productions. However, since he's written this, as he said, it gets to us after several weeks, Radio Harmony seemed to have disappeared. So more mystery surrounding that. Maybe they've just pulled the plug. After about a year, due to being raided, Radio East Coast Commercial returned on the 27th of October with some tests, firstly on 6290 and later on 6240. They're now using the address of PO Box 220342, 5600, Wuppertal 22 in Germany. Radio Peace in Action, heard on 13th of October on 6230 via Jolly Roger Radio, and on 6260 via the Northern Ireland Relay Service. Here in the northwest, a couple of the Merseyside stations have been off air for some weeks due to raids, he expects. Two stations are, however, operating at the moment, KISS FM on 100 MHz and Toxteth Community Radio on 104.9. This station features a variety of programming, including some Asian and Arabic. From Blackburn in Lancashire, two Asian stations have been broadcasting for some time now. Not able to identify them due to Asian languages used, but the stations operate on 100 and 101 MHz. And international radio news. Argentina has English to Europe from RAE, Monday to Friday, from 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock in the evening on 15345, and English to North America from 1 until 2 in the morning on 11710. Costa Rica, Radio Peace International, audible regularly of late from around 22:30 hours on 15030 with English programming. Luxembourg, after December the 31st, English will no longer be carried on 1440. once Lord Haw-Haw's transmitter. Of course, 208 has a very historic past. However, it'll be replaced by German, and the English will continue on 15350, which is intended for North America. That's a real shame, because I personally listen to that. I'll be sorry to see Luxembourg go, not being someone who really wants to shell out for a satellite dish, because I don't well like watching the rubbish TV that's on it. Oh, it's a shame. Russia, yet another new station now on the air and heard well here in the UK. Radio Anna operates from St. Petersburg on 7400 throughout the day and from 1700 hours on 5040. And the Voice of Vietnam can be heard English to Europe at 6 o'clock at night, 7 o'clock at night, 8 o'clock and 9:30, all on 9840 and 12018. Well, thanks again to Alan Dean for sending in those reports. It's Sparks from Radio Facts, this week presented by Andy Burnham, Trevor Brook and Dave Johns. Our address is Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1. The address: Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And even if you can't scrape together the coppers to send, well, I hope you don't send coppers on second thoughts, I guarantee to read your letter out on air.
Really a sight.
Yeah. You can have your fortune.
A report of the annual dinner of the British section of the Audio Engineering Society. Nearly 100 people attended the annual dinner of the British section of the Audio Engineering Society, which this year was held at the Charing Cross Hotel. Members and their guests joined in spirited conversation and then went into dinner, where the chairman of the section welcomed them. After a pleasant meal, the audience listened intently to the after-dinner speaker, John Drummond, controller of BBC Radio 3. In an often passionate, often amusing presentation, we were given a trip through some of the factors which determine the output of Radio 3. The serious content was, however, prefaced by some remarks which were calculated to wind up an audience of audio engineers. Of these, one of the most amusing was the observation that all the best-sounding concert halls were constructed before the subject of acoustics was established. The audience were amused to hear that there is no typical Radio 3 listener, rather a continuum of overlapping minorities, who often loathe the nectar of others. The point was emphasised by some recollections of listeners' views. Programming for an audience of that kind can only be a challenge, but one to be met with daring rather than caution. Fortunately for the radio audience, here was a man who opposed the divisiveness of disciplines which could otherwise result in a very narrow approach. John could hardly have failed to mention the trauma which broadcasting is currently going through, and the circumstances which will result in the world-class programming of the United Kingdom being sacrificed on the altar of profit. Politicians cannot distinguish between quantity and quality, and the lowering of standards was inevitable. Programming would become more cautious as more and more stations fought for audience share. It was hard for John Drummond to conceal a trace of bitterness at the prospect of a lifetime's work being eroded, but the length and strength of the applause he received would indicate that no one in the audience disagreed with him. That's a report of the annual meeting of the Audio Engineering Society, where the speaker was John Drummond, controller of Radio 3.
If you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radiofax Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has longwave, mediumwave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact, standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England, 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England, 0483 276 477, or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
Thank you.
two short items from Japan. Toshiba says it has achieved a breakthrough in nanotechnology by constructing a microscopic electric motor less than 0.01 of an inch in diameter. Toshiba says it is the smallest electric motor ever made and includes all the components of an electric motor, magnet, bearings and coil. The tiny motor also includes a microchip to control it. It was built using chip-making techniques and by very precise micro-machining techniques. Toshiba says the motor needs just 3 volts to operate and predicts that it will be used in microscopic machines that will enter the human body for medical tasks. Science fiction being brought to life by Toshiba. And calling Dick Tracy, Citizen Watch has announced the world's smallest colour LCD screen at just 200 square millimetres. Using the simple matrix formula, Citizen has devised a 140,000 pixel screen with a 50 millisecond refresh rate. From the spring, it will produce 400,000 units a month, with camcorder makers as its major customers. The device has many other possible applications, including the eye screens in virtual reality headsets and eye-mounted televisions. You're listening to Sparks on Radiofax, the frequency 6205 and 12255. In Skeptical Inquirer, that's an American magazine, a special report, Hi-Fi Audio Pseudoscience by Fred E. Davis. Magic and mysticism are alive and well in the world of high-fidelity audio. Although one doesn't ordinarily associate audio with pseudoscience, a surprising number of products are being offered with no scientific basis whatsoever to support their claims. The complex functions within a CD player are beyond the grasp of the majority of the public, and who are consequently susceptible and gullible to unsupported claims. One fascinating aspect of all these products, despite their diversity, is that they all claim to do essentially the same thing. Perhaps this also gives some insight into those areas of psychoacoustics most vulnerable to the power of suggestion. Here are some of the claims being made, and some brief evaluative comments about them. This is not an exhaustive list by any means. These were found merely by skimming through 3 or 4 audio magazines. It seems P.T. Barnum was no fool, and a selection of the products he lists. Electrotech EPC, $500, a digital alarm clock identical to the Micronta clock sold by Radio Shack for $24.95. Coherence Industries and an editor of Stereophile claim it will improve the sound of your audio system by plugging it into the wall, not to your stereo system. It is supposed to improve the conductivity of your household electrical system and have a smoothing effect on the motion of electrons. They don't mention if it is necessary to set the correct time to gain this improvement. Final, DigiClear 303 Protectant, Digital Touch and Pro Sonar. All of them spray-on buff treatments for CDs. Final claims it improves dynamics and transient response, improves bass articulation, improves low-level detail, improves image specificity and depth, improves timbral accuracy, decreases harshness and noise. Unless these products fill in scratches to make CDs that skip more functional, there is no other possible benefit. They can neither affect the analog circuitry nor alter the sound of a CD. Claims have been made concerning the reduction of jitter in the data stream from the disc, but this has not been proven to be audible. Other reported treatments include Armorall and RainX, although there was some evidence of Armorall causing damage. CD Stoplight, costing $14.95, a very expensive green felt tip marker to treat the edges of a CD, purportedly to absorb reflected light. The manufacturer claims that it will improve clarity, definition, ambience, and makes the sound dramatically smoother. This has received more press, both pro and con, than most audio myths. Distech PowerBridge 2, the Cardass QuadLink PC, HexLink 5 PC, Tara Labs Phase 2 PC, Oral Symphonics Missing Link, all replacement powerline cords. All promise better sound quality. And it goes on about them. TICE Pulse Technology. TPT is a material treatment system which significantly reduces electron noise. Normally, electrons flowing through a conductor move in a somewhat random and chaotic manner. TPT enables electrons to move in a more direct path, eliminating their chaotic movement and the electron noise it creates. TWEAK, a contact enhancer to coat electrical connectors, minimizing loss of signal and power in electrical connectors. A sample I tested was electrically inert up to 200 volts. It certainly doesn't do much for conduction, perhaps it prevents oxidation. I've read another article that has proper tests on that for use with rack backplanes and does indicate that it works. Sims CD Reference Bands, Monster Cable CD Sound Ring, Euphonic Technology CD Ring. All of these are elastic bands attached to the outer edge of a CD. They promise extended bass response, improved clarity, and enhanced dynamics. They reduce irritating intermodulation, distortion, and brightness in compact disc reproduction. An AccuPower, or a noise trapper, both around $269, are power line filters. Not necessarily a bad thing, but they promise detail, transparency, and imaging your audio components were designed to produce. It seems slightly far-fetched. The Mobile Fidelity Sound Lab Ultra Disc, CDs in which the metallization layer is gold instead of aluminium. And they go on in great detail about them, and also about the subtleties of loudspeaker cables, which we've covered in great depth in previous articles. So all in all, a roundup of some hi-fi lunacy in Skeptical Inquirer, which is a specialist magazine covering debunking of the paranormal. I'll have some other articles from those magazines in the future.
Smiling in the street, have gone without a trace. The street used to be free.